Hello?
Can we get some music?
Jeff, Karen, Kat, are you ready for this
one? UCR.
Go.
We say and hope we want, give it to you non-stop. Any place, any time, not afraid to speak our mind. That's just the way we roll, we never gonna tell. Unstoppable, original, uncensored radio.
I always get thrown off when I have to do this. Hello, Earth. This here is Uncensored Radio with, of course, I'm one of your hosts, Jeffrey Emmett. And alongside of me tonight, I have the one, the only, the fabulous Katrina A. Johnson from Nickelodeon's All That. How are you?
Hello, I'm fabulous.
You're fabulous. Well, also
yes.
Tonight we've got, you know, the fabulous as well. Lips, Jim Bob Hankins, running the switchboard. How you doing, Lips?
I'm doing fabulous. I like how you were almost unenthused on that introduction, though. Thanks.
You're welcome. also tonight, Miss Ashley should be gracing our presence at some point this evening, so we'll hold our breath and see what happens. I never know with you girls.
Right, we're unpredictable like that.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of unpredictable, I did pack up all my stuff and go to London last week on a whim.
I'm sorry. Could you run that by me?
I said I packed myself up and went to London last week on a whim.
And how does that work out?
It was fabulous. I got an invitation. One of my friends was there on business and said, hey, why don't you come along? And I said, hey, I think I will. So I just packed up and went over there, and I was only there for like 2 days by the time I got there. And then I hung out, went shopping, hung out with some of my friends from London, and I made them take me everywhere. And they took me to this store that was the coolest thing I've ever seen ever, called Selfridges. And it's rated like the number one store, department store in the world. And they'll literally get you anything in the world. And if they don't have it, and if nobody makes it, they'll get it made for you.
So you're telling me I could go to this store, and I decided I want a 1963 VW Beetle that may be also named Herbie. They could do that for me?
Absolutely. They'll get it for you. He might
and
have a British
charge me a whole bunch of money?
It, but they'll get it for you. Oh, no, they'll charge you an arm and a leg.
Well, what if I say they'll give me anything in the world, I would like $1 million, but I only want to pay $1,000 for it?
No, I don't think they'll do that, no.
Well, this is not really as good as it sounded.
Well, it's cool. I mean, they could still get you Herbie, you just got to pay for him.
Well, that's great. I mean, I could get him myself, but the problem is I ain't got that kind of money that they need. So unless they're going to be able to be like a genie, you act a rub the lamp, girl, and give me a little, you know, a little something-something, like, it's not going to work out for me.
Yeah, I know. It didn't work out that well for me either. I spent a fortune, and I came home with only a few items.
Ugh, rich problems, I'm telling you. I really wish I had them. Though, I have to say, if you look at the celebrities, all the people with loads and loads of money, they have just as many problems, but they're just, because I feel like they're all entitled, especially the ones that grew up with money, they have a whole different set of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Where I feel like 95% of America's problems could be solved with $1 million.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know about you, but I really think my bipolarism issues could be cleared with $1 million. I think I can make it go away. Because what do you not have to get up in the morning and be unhappy about?
I don't know. A husband that doesn't love you because he loves his secretary.
And that's okay because I'll go buy a new one.
You'll have the pool boy.
Yeah, like, hello, who cares?
All right. I can see that.
Yeah, you know, I could just, no, I don't care. Give me the money. and I'll show you happy.
Well, I don't know, though, because I have a friend, and we will call this friend Jennifer. Jennifer has a rich boyfriend, and he's cute, and he takes good care of her, takes her on exotic trips, but he does not have a nice package. And so, Jennifer...
Are you
really
going to tell me that her problem is that he doesn't have a nice package? And is this the Jennifer that I think it is?
Yes. And she wants to know if she should go back to her ex-boyfriend, who is not wealthy, but has a real nice package and was like, sweet, but wouldn't take her on exotic vacations and wouldn't buy her fancy presents and wouldn't take her places in a limo and, you know, doesn't know everyone in town to spoil her with, you know, fancy dinners.
Well, is the only problem about the package? Like, is he a great guy?
Yeah, he's a great guy. But the attraction isn't the same.
Then shut down. What is wrong with her? You need to text this bitch and tell her to call into the show because I'm going to rip her a new vagina. Because she is ignorant. This is the problem with women and us gays. We're never happy. Nothing's ever enough. We finally get somebody who can give us the world, and we find a problem. You know what? He's got enough dough. He can go get a little surgery to fix that problem downstairs and make it a little bit bigger. And if
what if
not,
he doesn't think he has a problem, though? What do you do?
Well,
like, you've got everything else, but...
It's not like they've been together for a week. It's been a minute. Like, talk to the man about the issues. Like, be honest. He's got, look, and here's the next thing. If she is going to leave him, she needs to be smart enough to get him to invest in her and buy her some businesses and get them in her name so that she has residual income. So that if she is going to leave him for Boy Wonder, she can then sustain her lifestyle without his income. Hello? Well, I don't understand what these blonde girls, maybe certain blondes or brunettes, are doing with their life when it comes to these men with billions of dollars. You're getting fancy gifts. See, I'm not that type of bitch. I'm practical. Like, I like a good vacuum cleaner for Christmas. Y'all bitches, no. I don't want a rock. I don't want a limo ride. I want a duplex with checks, okay? Like, I want a casino. I want a limo service that I'm running. I want a company. So if you want to buy
but now you have to start with like, smaller things
no.
so you can work your way
no.
up.
No.
You just go from, hey, take me to dinner at Applebee's, buy me a duplex? Like, is that how it works in your world?
Absolutely. Like, I don't understand. Like, you're going to go spend $10,000 on a trip to wherever, Tahiti, or whatever. No, take that $10,000 and invest in me so that I can feel that I'm worth it. Like, I want to be your equal, not slumming off you. So give me the opportunity to make my own money so that when we go on vacation, I can help flip the bill. Like, help me help you.
But don't you think that, in the beginning at least, a guy would rather take you on a trip because then he gets to go on the trip too? It's
okay.
Not just here.
I can see
Let
that
me...
after the first month or two. Okay? Month or two, I'll give it to you. But
after
the first
month or two, who are you dating that you go on vacation with after a month? I don't like somebody enough to spend that much time with them after a month. No way.
Honey, it's not about liking them. It's about liking the bank account. What is wrong with you? This is about money, not love. Oh, my God.
Jamesy, what do you think? What do you think, Jamesy? Would you go for the nice package and the good sex and the chemistry, or would you go for the nice perks?
I would go for the first one. I mean, the nice
personality. Oh, whatever. You're full of shit. No, you really would.
They're both nice, though. They're both nice. They're both nice, and they're both cute. But one, the chemistry and the sex is amazing, and the body is perfect, and the package is out of this world. And the other one, yeah.
Okay. I would, like, honestly, for me, it's all about personality and chemistry. So, like, I would choose the one that I got along with better. I mean, I'm not going to be going on a vacation with somebody after only knowing them a month, regardless.
What is wrong with you people? I'd go on vacation with them after a week.
That's how people get picked up and murdered, my friend. So, no.
Look, if you don't know somebody within a week, you got problems. I'm saying, come on. You know, there's a reason why they call them U-Haul lesbians, because after the second date, they're moving in.
They move in.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't get down like that. I want to take time to actually get to know you. I don't want to invest, you know, I don't want to invest myself into something that in 6 months isn't going to be shit. Like, I want to take my time, get to know you, you know, get to know your what buttons I can push, what buttons I can't push. You know, get to know who you are before I'm going to go on vacation with you, because I'm not going to meet somebody, start dating them, go on vacation or on a trip with them a week later, them get like super pissed off at me because I said one thing wrong.
You know what? I actually did that once.
Of course.
Okay.
Really.
Here's how that went down. I was a flight attendant, and there was this gorgeous, gorgeous guy at the gym, and we had been like stalking each other for weeks, and then we finally made friends, and we were talking and chatting and flirting at the gym, and then I found out he was a flight attendant. No, I found out he was a pilot on a private jet, and at the time I was a flight attendant. So I started talking to him about that, and I was like, I bet we know the same people. And he said, hey, do you want to go to Hawaii? Because I need a flight attendant next Wednesday. And I was like, yeah. Do I want to go to Hawaii with a hot guy that's going to pay me? Sure do. But, I mean, that was a little different because it was work-related.
Right.
It wasn't if they're a billionaire,
it wasn't A-list navigation.
They're not going to kill you. And what better way to get to know somebody than a fancy lavish trip somewhere in, you know, the islands?
Because
you know,
the thing is, not everybody travels well. Some people are real difficult. Some people are whiny. Some people don't eat normal.
And you know what? For $1 billion, I will deal with whiny, suck it up, and suck their toes if I had to. And you know how I feel about that.
Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness. That is too much right there. For a billion dollars, you would seriously... No, for $1 billion, you would give up your own pride and own self-respect to do something like that, really.
Yes.
Absolutely.
For a billionaire, absolutely.
In a heartbeat.
I don't know, man. I've known a few billionaires, and they're all real old and...
As long as there was the money going into my checking account so that I could sustain my life after I go running into the night, I'll do what I got to do.
He's sad now, but he's the only one of us that's married and that's not doing that right now. So,
exactly.
Well,
obviously, here's the thing. I had the opportunity years ago, and I've told this story many a times, but the guy was 50 and had no personality. I just don't have that much imagination. Like, it's got to have something going for him. Obviously, the guy that you're talking about in question, billionaire number one, is very nice, but just maybe has a weak package. Like, to me, that's kind of a non-issue.
Yeah, but, I mean, are you going to be faithful to this person? Like, are you going
to
actually marry them and fall in love and
you're
not
just
be
there
satisfied
to get a check.
Sexually?
You're there to get a check. This is a business transaction. This ain't about love. That's what you got. That's your problem.
I don't know. I mean, he's cute. He's cute, but I don't think I can.
No, not really.
No?
Jennifer's?
Yeah.
He was all right. He wasn't all that.
He's cute.
I mean, $1 billion don't make him look a lot more attractive.
Yeah, he's not a billionaire. He's a millionaire.
Okay, millions, billion. It's close enough, girl. I remember the conversation well. It's enough money to keep me happy for a long time.
There's a difference between a millionaire and a billionaire. There's a big
difference.
This is true. Difference.
But you can take those millions and make them into billions.
Yeah, you probably won't, but you could.
No, I would.
Yeah.
Because I'm greedy.
You probably would. I don't think most people would, though.
I'm like, if I had $1 million right now, the things that I could do to flip that around and make more money is just sickening to me. So maybe we could talk to the Jennifer's boo-boo, see, do he want to be friends? Oh, hang on. I have a fresh blood. Aaron, come here. Come in this room for a second. Close that door. Carter, you got to wait out there. So we're having a little debate on this radio show. There's a girl. She's dating a dude, got multiple millions, okay? But he's got a weak package. So she's talking about the ex that can't take her on trips and limo rides and blah, 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 but has a nice package. Which would you pick? Thank you. Money. Here's the money.
Oh, God.
That's from an outsider's perspective. Bitch on the move right there.
Okay. I did enjoy that bitch on the move.
Maybe given the circumstances, I would take, you know, I would go for the money. Just because I got some stuff that I need to take care of right now. So, yeah.
Right. Hello? It's called buy a toy. Obviously, she needs a fist. And I know they sell those at the stores. So tell her to go get one and take care of herself when he's not looking. I mean, what are you doing with your life, chick? And why
yeah.
does she not have a duplex?
I don't think they've been going out that long.
It's been since, like, the beginning of summer, if not longer.
Yeah, that's true. But that's not that long to say, hey, buy me a building.
Yes, it is. Are you crazy?
Are you crazy?
No. Like, tell me you love me. If you really love me, you'll buy me something so I can sustain myself, so I don't have to be mooching off you. Help me, help you.
No. I don't know. I think that they're a little more
like,
careful.
Okay, what is this? What maybe let's say this girl, what kind of industry is she in? Can we say that?
She's a bartender.
Okay. How are you going to be a millionaire and date a bartender and not want to hook her up? Like, I don't know. Maybe it's just me because I couldn't be selfish like that if I had that kind of boatload of cash. Like, I'd want to help somebody a little bit, and I would want my significant other to not feel inferior to me because at the end of the day, like, how do you not when it comes to that kind of money?
Right.
You know, unless you're just trying to be kept. But either way, like, I still expect a weekly allowance because when you're away, who's going to pay my light bill?
Right.
Hello? I mean, who's paying the light bill? Who's paying for the limo? And who's paying for the dom? That's the questions I need to know. And if you're not around and you're away on work, no. That's not fair.
Oh, Jeffrey, I love you.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, and if I'm not worth the money, then you go find somebody else. And then she don't have to worry about the problem because then small package man with boatloads of cash is fucking somebody else.
Yeah.
True.
So, what? I mean, what's the issue here? Get you a duplex with checks and then buy me a treat. I feel I deserve 10%.
See, I don't know.
I'd probably
go for the ex that has a good package and a good passion and a good sex.
Again, you
could
buy that. There's always a pool boy.
I know, but what if your man finds out that you're banging a pool boy, then your whole comfortable, happy life is done.
Okay, so here's what she needs to do. I think this will solve the problem. For me, make the guy go to the bank and get a whole bunch, like maybe like $10,000 in ones, and then throw it all over the bedroom. You cannot not be turned on and have passion rolling around in that kind of money. It's just not possible.
Well, now that's funny.
Instead of the rose petals leading to the bedroom, or, I don't know, is there a $1,000 bill? I don't know.
There is. I've seen one. I've got pictures on
Instagram. So instead of rose petals, tell them you want $1,000 bills lined all the way to the bedroom and sprinkle all over the mattress. Now, see, that would turn me on. I could find a passion.
I bet you could.
I really could.
Oh, you cracked me up.
Mm-hmm. But you know who's not finding money right now? No? No guesses? Nothing?
No, nothing.
Michael Jackson's family. They're kind of coming.
Yeah, they were found in the
right,
correct?
Yeah, well, you're cutting out, like, something fierce. I'm not sure if it's Blog Talk or your...
You're cutting out, too, something fierce. You've been cutting out.
Oh, James Talk.
Well, I hear static. Listeners are complaining of static, and I'm on Messenger with Blog Talk Radio right now.
Oh, for the love of God.
Yeah, are you the one that have enough money? Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. Well, we'll just let James play this little retro replay for the rest of the 40 minutes since you can't hear us anyway. And hopefully we'll see you again tomorrow night. Or not.
Or not, because it's not playing, it's not even playing a show.
Okay. No.
Thursday, and I am totally excited, as I know Jeffrey is very excited as well, because guess what, folks? We have New York Times best-selling author Steve Alton here with us tonight. I mean, can it get any better than that? It's one day until Friday, and we have a New York Times best-selling author on our show. I'm just almost speechless.
Well, I know anybody that is listening has heard me talk about him quite a bit. The last couple of weeks, just because, you know, I find the books amazing. They're fast-paced. The amount of research that he puts into these books, you know, you just, I can't put them down. I can't read them fast enough. I mean, I've read every novel he's done so far, and I have really no complaints. They're just that
That's
good.
Always a good thing. I mean, you know what, I almost feel like, it's good to hear that, like, there's still good books out there. I mean, not that there aren't good books, but it's almost like books have sort of fallen by the wayside as we get more into this, like, new age of social media and constant contact with Twitter on our phones. And, you know, you can be in the restroom stall and you're on Facebook on your iPhone.
Right.
You know, it's,
and then, like, the whole e-book thing?
I'm not a fan. I'm really not.
Yeah, I know he's, like, working on it, and I'll let him tell about what he's got coming up, and I think it's this month. I have one, and it's just not the same as picking up a book for me. It's just completely different. I have a harder time focusing on it, but I do, I mean, it's for convenience-wise, I mean, it's awesome, but I just, the feel of the book, I don't know, I can't get over it, and I'm just, I can't express the excitement that I have that he's going to be on with us in just a few seconds. Like, it's just amazing. And I feel like a total geek because I'm, like, so excited. You know, for other people, it's like a famous celebrity. Ah! You know, and this is somebody that I've read for years that I respect and admire so much. And then to hear his personal journey, it's just been amazing to me. And I can't wait for him to share that with everybody. It's just... it's unreal.
Yeah,
so
I'm actually excited about it. And for you guys listening online as well as over the phone, if you you know, want to share anything, we've got the chat room going. So if you're at the blogtalkradio.com/unscripted, you know, go ahead, scroll down to the chat room. We've got Madison on with us as always tonight. Hey, Maddie, what's up?
Hi.
Oh, there you are.
Oh.
Hi. We're looking for you. Hello.
What was it? Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. All right. So are you going to say something other than hi?
All I was going to say is that it's been a long day. It involved troopers, a alternator, and Auburn, New York, and flamingos.
And
well,
yep.
Flamingos.
You would have read Grim Reaper End of Days, honey, it would have been nothing compared to what you're about to hear.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yes. So, without further ado, Let's bring Steve Alton on with us.
Yay!
Can you hear me?
Hello, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Hi, Steve.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the kind introduction. That was very nice of you.
Well, it's the truth.
I'll certainly try to live up to it.
Well, you've done good so far, and I cannot... I've been on the edge of my seat for like 2 summers now, waiting for the last book in the Domain series. I'm like, come on, it's got to come. I need it.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but Phobos won't be the last one. There'll be one more after it. No, I changed my mind and extended the series.
Oh, that just makes me even more excited.
Only because the storyline asked for it, but... Phobos, I think, is my favorite of the three books so far.
Because it was so much fun. When I first got into it, like, I guess I didn't realize what I was getting into, and I am a very paranoid person about the end of the world, 2012, and aliens. Like, I just get uncomfortable, and when I got, like, you know, partway through it, and I realized what was going on, I was like, I had to stop reading it for a day because I got so nervous. I'm like, I was actually like, this could happen. Like, it was just so real to me. Like, this could really happen.
I really hate to say this to you, but he's also scared of cats, too. So, it's not saying too much about him.
Well, just,
Steve, I got to tell you that when Jeffrey was reading this book, it was like every 5 minutes I was getting a text message. And he's like, oh, my God, I'm so freaked out. You have no idea about this book and the calendar. And it just opened up a Pandora's box. It took weeks to calm him down.
Well, Domain was actually written back in 1998, and so it was sort of ahead of the curve with the 2012 stuff, and for that reason, the book sold okay in the United States, but about 7 or 8 years later, it took off in Spain and became the number one book in Spain, and then it took off in Mexico and Germany and Italy, and now it's having a nice run in the United Kingdom. So I'm very curious and hopeful to see how Phobos does in October.
I have a feeling it's going to do very well. Especially, I mean, the timing couldn't be better for it to come out. I mean, people are starting to get a little nervous.
I think the 2012 movie helped a lot, although it didn't really focus on the Mayan calendar and teach us what that deal was all about. It just sort of tied in into the date in a brief dialogue, and that was that.
I thought it was going to go in, and it didn't. I was kind of disappointed. And that just, I mean, especially after reading your books, I was like, come on, give me more. But it's still pretty scary stuff. Do you believe the world's going to end in 2012?
I believe that we're rapidly coming to a fork in the road, and it's going to be sort of a judgment day in some sense. You know, all these natural disasters that are happening, all the things that are going on in the world, you know, everything from peak oil to just to, you know, the overwhelming greed and corruption that's going on in the world. And, you know, I was just watching Keith Olbermann, who I love his show, and the Ohio congressman who has steadfastly been pushing to take away the vote from minorities and older people and the like, and was forcing Ohioans to have driver's licenses with them when they voted, got pulled over for a DUI, didn't have his license, and had a hooker in the car. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that's coming up in 2012. You know, what goes around is going to come around.
I agree. Like, I don't know if it necessarily will be the end of the world, but I feel like something's coming. And I mean, just our planet is due for some kind of a switch. Like, I think it's had enough of us abusing it. and the greed, and just, I mean, even in the shell game, the things that you wrote about, I was like, you know, it's something that I guess I didn't think about before, and that book made me stop and think about a lot of things that I guess I just hadn't really put thought into it before, with the government and oil, and it just kind of stopped me in my tracks and made me think, like, yeah, something's seriously wrong.
Well, not all the books, but a lot of the books try to take on reality in a, you know, and open your eyes to things that are actually happening out there, and tell it in the form of a fictional story that,
right,
you know, can have a greater impact than just a documentary or a nonfiction book.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's, I think, what has made me so attached to your books, is that you take fiction and you bend it with the truth so much that it almost becomes hard to separate the fact from the fiction.
I'm curious, Steve,
just,
what... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Madison.
I just wanted to know, like, I mean, obviously with writing these books and even hearing Jeffrey, you know, react to it, and obviously dealing with the extreme nature or even happening of basically karma catching up with us in 2012, what do you think is the craziest reaction you've gotten from maybe one of your readers or one of your fans to what you've written? You know, what was the craziest response that you got because of one of your books?
Crazy response. I think I had an email from a woman who decided that she was the reincarnation of Lilith, who was one of the characters in the books. And, you know, I said that, you know, I tried to talk her down and said, that's not who you are. You're not a succubus, and you're not this evil creature. You're, you know, so let's get off of that.
And that character is definitely evil.
Like, but she changes,
she
in Phobos.
Scares me a little bit.
Well, she's scary in Resurrection, but things have come around in Phobos, and it's an interesting plot line because you may actually like her in an evil sort of way.
I mean, I know, like, with the, you have the newsletter that you send out monthly, which I have, like, three different emails, and each one of them get it, so whichever one I've checked first at the beginning of the month, I have the update. And when you sent out and you gave, you know, your fans the preview, I was like, we got to, like, the last page in the preview, and I'm like, no! I mean, to see what that character went through as a child and what she was kind of able to accomplish, I guess, was kind of a big thing. I mean, obviously, you know, she's kind of superhuman, but it was amazing to me that the character evolved into what she did. And she
had
the plan. Well,
you've only seen the beginning of the iceberg, so.
I can't wait.
Yeah, that's a fun story. And scary, because there is a threat out there that could take us down in 2012, and you know, it's a crazy situation. It's driven by the ego of scientists who are hunting the Pulitzer, or not the Pulitzer, but the Nobel Prize, and you know, they basically built this machine in Geneva underground that collides protons at near light speed, and in an attempt to recreate the Big Bang, and it's an insane prospect, because in the process of doing so, they're creating miniature black holes, and one type of this black hole is called a stranglet, and a stranglet has the ability to escape the chamber and grow larger. And so why are they doing this? Well, they're doing it because they're in search of something called the Boson-Higgs element, which is nicknamed the God particle, and it's ironic that they should name something the God particle when they're trying to act like God. And, you know, if there's anything that we've learned about atoms, is that you don't split them, and you don't smash them together, because nothing good can happen from those two processes.
How about just not try to play God? Like, that in itself is just scary enough.
Yeah, I mean, there's no information that they're going to gain from that that's going to, you know, lead us down the journey of Star Trek or Voyage to the Stars or anything like that. It's just, you know, they're just theoretical, you know, quantum physics, and it's no good can happen from it.
It's like little boys drinking Pop Rocks and eating Pop Rocks and drinking soda. They're doing an experiment just to really see what happens, and I think they're messing with things that they don't really know what they're getting into.
Well, it's one thing to mess with yourself, and it's another thing to create a situation where the entire planet can get sucked into a black hole that you've created. And, you know, that's unfortunately a possibility. And that's the threat in Phobos.
And I love how in the book you have, like, the timeline of how it's just this, like, almost continuous loop. Like, I thought that was a very neat concept, and it kind of actually made me feel a little better when I got to that part, because I'm like, well, okay, if it ends in 2012, we'll just start over and see what happens this time. Like,
yeah,
I just
not this
love
time
how,
around.
Yeah, we do it a little better. Like, it was just, I don't know, I couldn't put it down, and even in Grim Reaper, how really, I mean, it was like the end of days, but by our own hand. That, I mean, I'm not even sure. Like, and at first, honestly, I read the blurb about it, and then I pre-ordered it, and it was great because it came out right up, like, by my birthday. So I was like, woohoo, happy birthday. But I was like, I don't know, like, Grim Reaper? Like, what's this going to be about? And then I read it, and it was another one I couldn't put down. It amazes me how you've been able to tie in what I didn't know how you were going to do it. And it ended up being this amazing book that I was like, again, like, this is stuff that we need to really be careful with what we're messing with.
Well,
biological issues,
you know, for your listeners, the basic story behind Grim Reaper, and Grim Reaper is a very layered story, is that a biochemical scientist who works at Fort Detrick introduces a man-made version of the bubonic plague at the UN, believing that she is the tool to introduce revelations to the world. And, you know, she's a little bit psychotic, but these biowarfare weapons are actually being made as we speak at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and Battelle Labs in Ohio, and, you know, it's scary stuff, and, you know, there's something in the Bible that basically states that when negativity, you know, the scales of justice are, you know, pulled toward negativity and darkness, that the angel of death will walk the earth. And there's been several times in the history of mankind that the angel of death has walked the earth. The first time, you know, depending upon what you take out of it, is the story of Noah, when Noah built an ark, not to carry animals, but to keep the angel of death out, because civilization at that point had grown so negative, and so much corruption and so much greed and negativity and hatred in the world, that God said, okay, enough's enough. You build yourself an ark to keep the angel of death out, because that's it. The second time, which is a little bit scarier, happened in 1346, when bubonic plague raced out of Asia and crossed into Europe and Africa, and was so devastating that it wiped out 60% of the entire world's population. And this was at a time, you know, in 1346 that, you know, people got around on horseback or you know, they did have ships, sailing ships, but you know, the vector was the flea, and the flea bit the rat, and the rat passed on bubonic plague to humans. What's scary is that between 2012, which is the Mayan's doomsday, and 1346, which is when bubonic plague started, the amount of years difference is 666. So, you know, that's the next time that the Grim Reaper is supposed to make its appearance.
And that's what I love, that you've incorporated all of these, you know, facts and, I mean, you know, some people may call them myths, whatever, into the books, and it's just, I just can't say enough how it just captivates you and keeps you like, oh, wow, you know, like, it's just, it's amazing, and in Grim Reaper, it's just, with, I mean, when we had Anthrax, like, I kept thinking about that, and like, this is dangerous stuff, we should not be messing with things that we can't fix. And I mean, I don't really want to give away the book, but what happened, you know, it got loose in New York, and what were they going to do? There was no way to control it. But to kind of eradicate the whole city. I mean, and that's something that could be a very realistic thing in the near future if we let it go on. It was very frightening. But, and I loved your author's note, just, I mean, it moved me when I read it, to find out what had happened to you. Can you share with everybody what happened to you on May 5th in 2009 with your wife?
Well, it was during the writing of Grim Reaper, and Grim Reaper's a book about good and evil, and, you know, cause and effect, and on that night, my wife had gone to a vitamin shop around the neighborhood, and while she was in there, two armed men in masks came in with guns and robbed the place, and basically took her and a clerk and duct taped them to the floor and bound them and gagged them and put a gun to their head, and, you know, that could have been it. And, you know, it's a scary situation. And in the author's note, you know, I basically state that, you know, I had been introduced to Kabbalah, which is a study of spirituality and sort of the science of spirituality that is 4,000 years old and comes from the Book of Formation, which was written by Abraham, the patriarch, and, you know, had something horrible happen to my wife, had she not survived, I don't know what I would have done. And it sort of put me in the same shoes as my lead character, who had a family situation as well.
It definitely, I mean, I read that, and I just, my heart stopped for you, because I couldn't imagine, and just the fact that you were writing this book about good and evil, and something like that happens. And I mean, and just to go through that, I mean, with your wife, I can't even imagine how hard that must have been after for her. Just, I'm sure that she had tons of emotions that just...
She did.
I wouldn't know how to go back out to the store.
Well, what helped her is that her Kabbalah teacher explained to her that, you know, it's possible that her presence there, you know, kept people from getting hurt. That, you know, her belief in you know, the Creator's light and kept her safe and kept them safe. So that gave her something that she could live with. And so that helped.
I mean, that's amazing. I love in here you say, but who knows, perhaps one day the man who held a gun to my soulmate's head will pick up this novel and garner the spiritual tools he needs to transform his own life. So from that, I'm assuming he wasn't caught.
No, he wasn't caught. And, you know, the premise behind that is that from the greatest darkness has the potential for the greatest light. And so, you know, even someone who has done horrible things can transform their behavior and contribute to society in a positive way and, you know, bring light to the world.
And I thought, you know, that was so, I mean, honorable of you to put that in there. And I just thought, how amazing would it be if that person does read the book someday, finds out that it was your wife, and reads that, and maybe it will change his life. And hopefully for the better. I mean, it's just... it's unreal that these things happen, and it just in the way that it happened. And I feel bad because also you've lost your father recently.
Yeah, it's been rough.
And then 2007, right? You were diagnosed with Parkinson's?
Yeah.
And how, and I know that's definitely done affected in your life, as you shared with us in the newsletters. Can you, how has it changed your life, I guess?
Well, you know, everybody has challenges, and I certainly have mine. And there are, you know, from my perspective, there are people who have it a lot worse than I do.
Right.
So, you know, I consider myself lucky for the problems that I have. How does Parkinson's affect me? Well, it affects the right side of my body. Sometimes it's noticeable, sometimes it's not. It's something that causes rigidity, so that it feels like, you know, at times there's, you know, lead flowing through the blood in my wrist or my forearm. And it can get a little uncomfortable at times, but, you know, my choice of combating it is not to go on drugs.
Wow.
Because the drugs can cause the same symptoms as Parkinson's. Michael J. Fox went on the drugs in an attempt to continue his acting career, and they put him on heavy drugs right away, and, you know, the heavy drugs are dopamine, because Parkinson's is a lack of dopamine, which helps you control the muscular impulses and nerve impulses. So they put you on dopamine, and then your body gets used to it, and you have to go on more dopamine and more dopamine, and I just didn't want to do that. So I take a half a pill, which is an Azilect, which is a drug that's not dopamine, which doesn't affect me, but it's said that it could push the symptoms away for some years so that it doesn't worsen. But I've also had a stem cell treatment that is sort of a breakthrough going on here in Boynton Beach, Florida, where there's a doctor who has discovered that by releasing your body's own stem cells in large quantities for on and off periods, the stem cells, you know, are sort of like a universal healer going through your own body and can help restore some of the stolen effects of Parkinson's. So I had that done last summer. I hope to have it done again because it definitely did help.
Wow. Is it something that you're going to have to, like, continue to get yearly?
No, I don't think so. I think for the people that I've met who have Parkinson's, who underwent the treatment, their results were a little bit better than mine was because their symptoms were a lot worse.
Right.
It's also possible that I've discovered that I had high levels of metal in my body, mercury and lead, which has been taken out through chelation process. And I think that the stem cell treatment would have probably worked better if I had had that done first. But I didn't know.
Right. Isn't that really dangerous to have that removed? I was just reading about that the other night.
It's not dangerous to have it removed. It's the process of removing it is actually simple, but you can pick things up in the environment, or, I mean, even certain types of shampoos have metals in them, or you know, you never know what you're going to. I mean, I'm pretty careful about the things that I eat, but you never know what it's from. So, you know, and we don't live in an area that has high pollution, air pollution, and we drink water that's purified through reverse osmosis. So, but you just never know what's in your body. And I think those things can contribute to disease.
Right. Well, I mean, it amazes me. I mean, even just looking at Michael J. Fox, to see, I mean, 10 years ago to where he is now, I mean, it's very heartbreaking. And I mean, from looking at it from my perspective, from growing up with him, I mean, it seemed, even though he had it for so long, it seemed to me like it happened very rapidly once, like, he was on Spin City and he had to leave. Like, so, I mean, to me, like, that was very scary. And when I first, you know, read that you had it, I was like, how is this guy going to continue to write?
Well, people get it in varying degrees, and he's sort of the poster child for Parkinson's along with Muhammad Ali, but, you know, my symptoms are nowhere near like that. I mean, you can see me and I can just be sitting there and you wouldn't know that I had Parkinson's. Usually I don't have too many tremors. Sometimes I have no tremors at all. So exercise is a big thing that helps Parkinson's, and I've always been an exercise demon, and I've always taken care of myself that way. And so I find that when I work out, you know, the Parkinson's symptoms lessen. So I work out. So it's sort of a motivating factor to get my ass to the gym at 11 o'clock at night if I haven't gone. And then I, you know, I'm fortunate in the gym that I work out. It stays late, it stays open late, so it accommodates my schedule.
I can't imagine. I mean, how is the writing process? Do you bury yourself in a room for days on end when you get into a writing mode? Like, how does, I mean, how do you have time for your family in the gym? And I mean, just dealing with the doctor.
Well, you know, it's, you know, I work out of my house and I have an office upstairs, and you know, every day is a little bit different. You know, I'm working on a new project right now, a new novel called The Omega Project, but, you know, I started my day and checked my email, and my agent had emailed me, and he said he sold the rights to Goliath to Spain. And
for a movie?
No, no, for novel, the novel rights. And Goliath is a book that was written in probably 99, actually, I think it was 2001. I think I'd finished it right after the September 11th. So, you know, a lot of things have changed in the story of Goliath, because, you know, it deals with a submarine that basically goes after the guy who hijacks the sub, uses it as a tool to fight dictatorships and authoritarian governments, and the computer that's in charge of the ship has a mind of its own and is learning from the bad guys. So, but in the original book, Iraq was nuked and Saddam was still around, and since then obviously things have changed, so I need to go back before we send it to Spain and swap out a couple nations here and there, and it means me going through the whole book. So instead of writing the Omega Project today, I've spent the days on Goliath. So every day is a little bit different, and you have to sort of adjust your schedule based upon the needs of publishers and or movie deals or whatever it might be, you know, that can take a while.
And now, are we going to be getting a sequel in America to Goliath anytime soon?
Well, the storyline of the Omega Project is actually what was originally Sorceress, and it was just such a great storyline that everyone who heard it said, you know, you got to let it stand on its own. So I sort of put Sorceress on the back end and back burner and started working on Omega.
I mean, I am definitely a person, when I've read the books like Goliath, it's just one of those books, like, one is not enough. There's just so, I'm like, I know there's more of a story, especially the way it was ended, which is kind of like, I'll be back. And it's just like, yeah. And now, am I crazy, or was there a little tie-in with the submarine in one of your other books?
Well, I had used the name Goliath in The Trench for this big oil tanker that had been converted to a fusion reactor. And when the storyline for Goliath came out, I wanted to use the name. So it's not really much of a tie-in. They share the same name, but, you know, a little different.
Oh, I thought there was something with the one of the guys, maybe from Meg, that had actually created the submarine. I could have just connected it all in my own head, though.
I think you may have.
It happens. I'm just, like, always looking. I don't know. But I just, that was another one that I couldn't put down. I think I had read it in less than a day. It was just, it's an amazing book. And then, of course, what got me started, I did a cross-reference because I had a very, very hard time reading as a child. And it stuck with me to adulthood where maybe I'd read a book a year. And then I picked up this one book when I was nannying. I couldn't put it down. And then that was it. So I did a cross-reference, and your name came up for Meg. And I loved Jaws as a child. Loved it. I remember when the movies were on USA, we'd tape them on our, you know, VHS player and watch them. So when I was like, oh, a shark book? I'm like, this, I ran to the library and I got the book. It was another one I couldn't put down. And I was just so captivated. I'm like, it makes Jaws look like a goldfish. I mean, how did you come up with that concept?
For Meg?
Yeah.
I also liked Jaws when I was growing up, and in addition to reading Jaws, I read, a lot of great white shark attack stories that really happened, and there was always a little blurb about Carcharodon megalodon, the prehistoric cousin of the great white, but there was never anything commercially written about it. And when I was 35 and juggling my career a little bit, I picked up a Time magazine, and on the front page, on the cover, was the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of the planet, 7 miles down this 1,500-mile-long gorge. And as I read the article, and I read about hydrothermal vents and the different sort of species in the abyss, I recall the little blurb about Megalodon, and immediately went to the library because there was no internet back then in 95 and all the way back then. And I searched the shark books until I found the picture. And I set a goal that I was going to write this book, and I was going to take 30 days to research it as much as I could. And then I'd start writing it. And because I had a job, what I call a J-O-B, just over broke, the only time I could work on the book was at 10 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning and on weekends. And so I set up shop in my living room table and with the dining room table, and which kind of pissed my wife off a little bit. And I said, this is what I want to do. So basically by writing 2 to 3 pages a night, I was able to finish it in about 6 months and start to search for an agent. And Meg was actually my first book and the biggest deal that I've gotten on a book deal.
And it's
been a roller coaster ever since.
Was that your first time that you decided you want to write with this book? Because I know before it said that you were at a general manager's job at a wholesale meat plant.
How do you go from that to writing?
I had gone
to school as a physical education major, and I actually wanted to coach basketball. And I went through 10 straight years of college to get a doctorate degree to have something to fall back on. And my last year of writing a dissertation, I happened upon a job selling water treatment equipment, whole house water treatment equipment, and turned out to be pretty good at it, and to the point that they offered me to open a factory distributorship in Wilmington, Delaware, and I did that for a while, and things went into a little bit of a roller coaster there, and ended up moving to Florida and opened up a smaller company and teetered with that a little bit and then bounced around on a couple different jobs. From the water treatment company, I had set things up that I was working for myself, essentially, because the overhead was just too high. And one day I got this weird call from a guy who said, "Is this Steve Alton?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I could have been your father." And I just sort of wondered what kind of genetic mishap I had been involved in. And it turns out that the guy used to date my mother when she was 17 years old, and for some reason he decided to check up on me. And he invited me to his company to meet him, and it turns out he owned this wholesale meat company. And 2 hours later, I had talked myself into a job as a sales manager and got out of the water industry and was working for him, and he promoted me to general manager in 6 months. And things were going so well that the board of directors, made up of his stepsons, decided that they didn't need me anymore. So on Friday the 13th, on September 1996, I lost my job. And 4 days later, Meg was auctioned to the six biggest publishing houses in New York and garnered this huge deal.
I mean, that's what dreams are made of right there. I can't imagine a better story.
Well, you know, there's more to the story. You know, Meg had been optioned. We had gotten an option from Hollywood Pictures before the book went on auction, and that's what pushed up the deal. But it was part of a two-book deal. And the second part of the book deal was this Mayan calendar story, which at the time was called Fathom. And when I went to write the book, I wanted to tell the story of the Mayan calendar and the publishing house, Bantam Doubleday, which did Jaws 25 years earlier. All they wanted was an underwater story. And Domain is not an underwater story. I mean, there's elements of it that are underwater, but it's the calendar story. And rather than make a fuss because so much money was at stake, I just wrote the book that they wanted me to write, and it wasn't very good. And 2 weeks before I was supposed to get paid $1 million, if you can believe that, they canceled the book. And, you know, that was, you know, like a pretty bad punch in the gut. And I had just moved in, my family and I had just moved into a brand new house from an apartment, and I knew I was going to lose the house, and I had just gotten a brand new car, and I knew I was going to lose the car, and all the little toys that I bought on the first deal, I knew I was going to lose, because I owed taxes to the government and was planning on paying those things with the book deal. But we settled. I had to sue them, and we settled out of court, so that I could get the rights back to the book. And I took some time off because I had spent 2 years with it, and wrote Trench, which was sold to a second publisher. And by that time, I'd gotten the rights back to the book that would eventually become Domain, and sold that. So, you know, I was able to write the ship. But you know, it definitely Bantam Doubleday. In order to save face, because Meg had been such a big bestseller, you know, that they had to justify firing the author. but what had happened was, it wasn't the book that they fired me for. It was the fact that Doubleday had been purchased by Bertelsmann, which is this huge German conglomerate, and the outgoing president, Arlene Friedman, was trying to make her bottom line look better to keep her job. So anyone who had been given a high advance in the beginning, they, by dropping their contracts, they could save the advance, and that would have made her books look better. And so myself and a few other authors were caught up in that mess, and you know, it was not very good.
I can't imagine. That's tough. I mean, that, to have all of that, like, handed and then pretty much taken away, that is just,
well, you know, I could say it now, I couldn't say it at the time, but, you know, there was the positive in the negative, you know, the silver lining was that it forced me to become a better author. It forced me to be more concerned with my character development and elements of the story and the writing. Because Meg had done really well because everybody loves reading about a 70-foot great white shark, but, you know, at some point you have to develop into becoming a better writer, and this was the impetus that forced me to become a better writer and learn my craft, and my books are far better now. Every book is a little bit better. I mean, I spent the day working on Goliath. What? Goliath was the fourth book that I wrote, and, you know, Omega is the 12th, and in between the fourth and the 12th, I've become a better writer. So as I'm reading the passages, I'm changing them now because I don't like, you know, some of the wording, and I want to make it a little bit better.
And I mean,
but you can drive yourself crazy doing that. you know, writing and editing, and you can edit yourself into a corner.
God bless you, because I mean, Mike can attest to this. Not like, and I'm sure you can probably even acknowledge it, because when I send an email, like, my grammar is horrible. I would have loved to have been a writer, but I have no imagination. I can write a blog, but I can't write. So to see, like, it just amazes me that the stories that, I mean, you've come up with, like, I don't think I could ever be that creative. And it's just the way, I mean, it's captivating, because I didn't think it was just a shark book. Like, there was, like, science involved with, you know, the trench and the submarines. I thought it was better than Jaws. There was more to the story and more science.
Well, from my major criticism of Jaws, I mean, how do you criticize Peter Benchley and 10 million books sold? But
right.
And he certainly was an amazing writer. But the one thing that, if for me as a 15-year-old reading Jaws, was that I wanted more shark.
Right.
I mean, any chapter that was about the shark was cool, but it was like it was a tease. And then we had to listen to Brody and him, you know, and or Hooper urinating in Ellen Brody's bathroom or whatever it might be. And, you know, that's all fine, but, you know, let's get back to the shark. So
yeah,
when
like
I wrote Meg, you know, I made sure that there was a lot of shark in the book. And when I wrote Hell's Aquarium, you know, I have dueling stories going on between one shark story and the other shark story. So, you know, you get plenty of action.
That was exciting, especially because we learned what other creatures are in the trench. I was like, oh, we could go lots of places with this. Is there possibly any spinoffs coming?
Not a spinoff. There'll be one more book in the Meg series, Night Stalkers, but I won't even start that until the Meg movie moves into production.
Yeah. Oh, that is a great thing, which I also wanted to cover, because I keep seeing it's going into production, it's in development hell, it's a possibility. What is the latest update on the Meg movie?
Well, you know, just as a backstory, Meg was optioned before my first book deal, and Hollywood Pictures bought it, which is part of Disney, and they went through two lousy scripts, you know, the rights were reverted when the president of Hollywood Pictures, David Vogel, was fired. So the rights came back to me, and nothing happened for a while, and then through my friend Nick Nunziata, who's the founder of Chud, we got the book to Guillermo del Toro and Lloyd Levin and Larry Gordon, and they loved it, and they took my script that I had written at the time, and then Jan DeBont was added to the mix, who was the director of Twister, and Jan had his own take on the story, and so we worked on a script together, and we sent it to New Line, and New Line optioned it, but New Line wanted to work with Shane Salerno, who wanted to work with Meg, so Shane Salerno rewrote the book as a script, and unfortunately, Shane went, you know, way out in left field.
Wasn't there something about a flying shark or something somewhere?
No, the flying shark script came from Hollywood Pictures. Shane's contribution was to make the shark growl, to which I said that if you don't remove the growl, I'm going to go postal on all of you and kill you.
yeah. Wasn't it growling in Jaws 4?
Yeah, something like that.
Shark
pig. No.
Yeah, and it was, like, insane. Like, what the hell is the shark doing?
But Shane basically wrote Moby Dick with a shark, and to New Line's credit, they didn't like it. But the rights reverted again, and then I had a friendship with producer Belle Avery, who's not a big-time producer, but what she's good at is sourcing money. And she's
nice.
Got a lot of contacts, and she basically said, well, let's shed all the, you know, the garbage that's attached to this book and go write a new script and, you know, stay on the novel. And I did, and we worked on the script together, and it's a great script. In fact, we showed my script and Shane Salerno's script to 25 people and took our names off of it, and all 25 overwhelmingly voted for my script. And
Nice.
Couldn't wait to see the movie. So with that script, we went out and got financing, and we have some bigwigs over in China are going to finance it for $150 million, and they're at the point now where they're just finalizing the paperwork. You know, it'll be an American movie and with American director or maybe a Chinese director, I don't know, but, you know, it'll be first class all the way, and the script's good. So,
well,
you know, the most important thing about
a fat dude that they need to kill in the first 10 minutes, tell them to call me. I would just love, like, when you did the contest, oh, it's like, I want to be a dead body. But I cannot wait. I think this movie will be huge. I believe it to be huge.
And personally,
I think it will too. I mean, I think it's going to be the number one grossing movie of all time for its time, for its period. But
I agree.
If it's done right, and I think that it will be done right, and it starts with a good script and good characters and good storyline. You can't depend upon the special effects. If you have a good story, then the special effects just aid the story.
Right. But I think, well, too, because you wrote the book, the script needs to come from you. Like, I don't want to see somebody else's script on the movie screen. I read the book. I want to see how you would translate the book into a movie, not somebody else. And I think that's where books and, like, I can't stand it. I cannot read a book and watch a movie. It just doesn't work for me because the book always blows away the movie.
And there's a reason for that, and that's because two reasons. One is because the author sweats the details and gets the story right, whereas a screenwriter doesn't have the time to investigate, do the research on a story, so they come up with the first thing they come up with. And the second reason is because the WGA, the Writers Guild, sets up a rule which deals with subsidiary rights and royalties and things like that, and that is that if you want credit for the script, you have to have changed at least 30% of the original material. So they automatically build in change from the original source material. So for something like Meg, which has undergone several scripts, everyone who takes it it's sort of whispered down the lane. The original message is so blurred by the time it gets back to you because everyone's changing it. Whereas for me, the author, I don't care about the credit because I wrote the novel. I just want the best. I just want the best script. I just want the best storyline. And
there has not been a shark movie that, I mean, there was that one, like 10 years ago, other than Jaws, really. Like,
the funny thing about Deep Blue Sea is that when Meg was originally optioned, the agent in charge of the option worked for ICM, Jeff Robinoff, and he and David Vogel, the head of Hollywood Pictures, did not like each other. But he optioned him Meg, and while Meg was in development, Robinoff became the head of Warner Brothers. And so he greenlit Deep Blue Sea to try to attack David Vogel. And ironically, Deep Blue Sea was the picture that got made and not Meg.
I mean, and even for me, like, I watched that movie, I can't even count how many times, just because I was so desperate for a shark movie. Like,
I think there is a 3D shark movie coming out this summer, which looks really stupid, but
Like, they had anything with the water, I'm obsessed with, and I'm mortified of the ocean, but I just love it. Like, they had that Piranha movie, and I was like, okay. Yeah, not so much. So I have been, like, waiting. So I'm hoping and praying that this movie comes out soon. And it would have been great if it comes out before the end of the world. I'm not going to be happy if I have to go and don't get to see Meg on the big screen, okay?
You and me both.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, and I know you have some exciting news about an e-book that's coming out, right, relatively soon?
Yeah, I mean, it should be in July. What happened was I think Meg was the only book that possibly the Trench too that didn't come out as an ebook. And with publishers, the publisher who options the book gets all the ebook rights. But Meg has been through some weird situations. It was originally, you know, printed by Ban of Doubleday, and then when we knew New Line Cinema was buying the rights to the book, my friend purchased the rights back because he had a publishing company, and so Tsunami Books published it for a couple years. And then Tsunami Books went out of business, and I had to buy the rights back to Meg, and the problem was that the book went out of print. And the Adopt an Author program, which is the program I founded that helps high school reluctant readers, had 10,000 teachers, and the 5,000 active ones were using the book. And so they had run out of books for their classroom, so I had to get the book back into print immediately. So I optioned it to the movie producer, and she had the book printed up and for the teachers. But she had never done the ebook. So we have a company that just does ebooks is going to do Meg, and they said, well, you know, as sort of a free giveaway or a 99-cent giveaway, can you write a prequel? And I said, well, actually, Meg lends itself to a prequel because the story deals with what happened to Jonas Taylor 7 years ago,
right,
but never really delves into it too much. So the Meg prequel is what happened 7 years ago. It's the entire story. But it's only, you know, maybe an 85-page book. And
well, it's 85 pages I'm looking forward to.
It's
so
fun.
I cannot wait.
It, for people who like Meg, there's, like, little things in the book that they'll be like, oh, man, that's cool, because I know what happens to him or I know what happens to her. And, I don't know if it's not going to be printed. It'll just be an e-book because it's a giveaway. And I have to think of a way to get it to readers who don't have, you know, Kindles or, you know, whatever.
Well, I just got the first ebook, and I'm telling you, I'm not loving it so far. There's just nothing the same as a book.
There's
but
nothing like a you know, I'm not an ebook fan. I prefer to hold a book and turn the pages mm-hmm. myself. And
I like seeing it on my shelf after I've done reading it, and then I go back, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It's just something about the physical, the smell, the touching, the turning of the page. Like, I just love it. The ebook thing, but I'm telling you, I'm on this. The prequel, I cannot wait. Do you have an exact date of when it's coming out?
Not yet. I just did the final edit on it a day before the newsletter came out. So they're reading it now, and once they give the thumbs up, they'll give me a date. I'm guessing towards the end of the month. But if you check on Amazon, you know, once they announce it, it'll be announced.
Well, Steve, I cannot thank you enough for coming on. I mean, I could probably spend a week just talking to you about the books, and I'm really upset that I didn't get enough time to talk about Adopt the Author program that you started, so I'm hoping that you will come on with us again, and we can talk about that more. And I'm hoping you'll come on again, too, the next time your books are coming out, because I just can't get enough. And I just want, you know, all of my friends, I've promoted them on Facebook, I've told everybody they've got to read them, and I'm just honored that you came on with us. So anytime you want to come on, you've got something going on, please let us know, and you are more than welcome. And I definitely would like to do more with Adopt an Author, because I think it's a great thing that you did for a lot of kids.
Well, I appreciate that, and, you know, we'll stay in touch, and I'll come on again.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the great things about you, I have to say, is I have emailed you numerous times throughout my different emails, and I'm like, God, this guy's got to be, I'm going to be driving him crazy. You have emailed me back every time I've had a question about a book or anything, and I really appreciate that, and I think that's what makes you such a great author. You know, to do that for your fans, that's just amazing.
Well, without my fans, I don't have a career, so.
Well, I want to thank you again, Steve, for coming on, and I will definitely be emailing you so we can hopefully get something set up with Adopt an Author and maybe get some people that are involved in it as well with you. I want to thank you for coming on. We've got about 30 seconds left, everybody. I want to thank everybody that's listening. I can't thank Steve enough. I can't believe it's over. I'm kind of disappointed. But we will see you all tomorrow, and make sure you visit our website to get the link to Steve's site and get his books, guys. You're going to love them. You will not be able to put them down. We will see you tomorrow. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
This has been a presentation of Unscripted Radio.